While Biden was speaking about the economy, he really tried to express to Americans that he feels their pain when it comes to inflation, although I'm not sure about his choice of words. Well, watch this.
Look, I know you got to be frustrated. I know. I can taste it.
Wow.
Americans heard and responded with a resounding, ew.
That's... Yeah. Yeah. Sharp. Yeah.
President Biden on defense over high consumer
taste
prices.
Taste of inflation in the morning.
Says inflation is a top domestic priority. And again, takes aim at MAGA Republicans. We're going to play for you his new comments and have the new inflation report when it crosses later this morning. Plus a mixed night for Trump-backed candidates in yesterday's primaries with a win in West Virginia, but a loss in Nebraska.
Boy, that Nebraska loss statewide, and it may show again, it may be easier for Donald Trump to win in smaller congressional races, much harder statewide in states like Nebraska, possibly Pennsylvania. We'll see.
We'll discuss what this says about the former president's hold on the Republican Party. And Ukraine reports new gains in Kharkiv, saying it has managed to recapture villages and is pushing back Russian forces. We'll have the latest on the counteroffensive in a region that has come under constant attack.
You know, Willie, Kharkiv, this battle has been raging since almost the beginning of the war. We have seen as every morning we go to Clint and he goes to the maps and he just shows us all the Russian goals. And Kharkiv's one of them that the Ukrainians, you see the blue, the counteroffenses expanding by the day. This news out of Kharkiv, if confirmed, very good news for the Ukrainians.
Yeah, it's extraordinary news. I mean, Russia is making some progress in the Donbass, but if you look at the broader goal, as you said, of what Vladimir Putin set out before he changed the goalposts a few weeks ago, set out to do was to roll across Ukraine, and the map tells the story right there. He's getting some of what he wants, although not all of what he wants in the Donbass. But in terms of these major cities, I mean, Kharkiv is a northeastern city. He thought he was going to be well into and have a hold of by now, let alone going into places like Kyiv. So he has failed at that. Zelensky has succeeded on that side of the Ukrainian military, has done its job. But the fight rages on in the east.
It really does. And by the way, Mika, as we set this up for everybody, there's conflicting reports about what's going on in Donbass. Pentagon doesn't see a lot of progress from Russia. The Russians say they're doing quite well there. So we will let our viewers decide whether they believe the Pentagon or whether they believe the Russians.
Yeah.
And if you believe the Russians, well, there are other channels for you, both here and abroad.
Okay, with us we have U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC News, Katty Kay. Columnist and Associate Editor for The Washington Post, David Ignatius, is with us this morning. And host of Way Too Early and White House Bureau Chief at Politico, Jonathan Lemire. We will begin with that major development for Ukrainian forces that they have reportedly recaptured key territories near the country's second largest city, Kharkiv. President Volodymyr Zelensky says troops retook four villages north of the city. These are the places the Russians had captured. They got it back. He also said Ukrainian successes were gradually pushing the Russians away from the city, which has seen constant bombardment since the war began. Officials say the counterattack near Kharkiv could signal a new phase, with Ukraine now going on the offensive. Ukraine says its forces are also engaged in a fierce fight on Snake Island to drive out the Russians. The island, located in the Black Sea, about 80 miles off the coast of the city of Odessa, is a strategic prize for the Kremlin. The Ukrainian military says it is using drones and fighter jets in an attempt to drive out Russian forces. The military released this video over the weekend of what it said was a strike on a Russian helicopter. According to the British military, Ukraine's assault on the island is helping disrupt Moscow's attempts to expand its influence. During the early days of the invasion, Ukrainian soldiers stationed on the island used an expletive to rebuff a demand by the now sunk Russian warship Moskva to surrender.
Yeah, you know, David Ignatius, so much of what we hear coming out of the war zone, it comes out in the fog of war. And you can't help when you hear whether it's coming from the Russians or whether it's coming from the Ukrainians or even if it's coming from British or American intelligence. It's almost like you have to, you can disregard a lot of the Russian information but we're still sorting through this right now. And earlier on, way too early, Richard Haass talked about a stalemate, in Eastern Russia. Is that how you'd put it right now, based on all the information you have?
Yeah, Joe, I think we're in a period of prolonged, slugging it out on the ground. The Ukrainians are taking some territory back. The Russians continue a relentless, slow push west in the Donbas region. I think the hardest contest will be along the Black Sea coast. The really quite horrific rocket attacks on Odessa are a sign of that. The point I think that U.S. analysts have been trying to make is that in this period of Russian difficulty, not much progress, sometimes mixed martial arts analysts talk about ground and pound as the strategy that fighters are using. That's what we're seeing, ground and pound, tough tactics day to day. In that period, the Russians may grow frustrated, and they may seek to escalate this conflict in ways that would be dangerous for the United States and NATO. I think that's the message that we're hearing from U.S. officials, from our intelligence chief, Avril Haines, yesterday in her testimony. But on the ground, I think we're seeing small changes in position, but not the fundamental changes. Kharkiv victories are an important sign that Ukraine is still able to fight back, but we shouldn't see a big strategic meaning in that.
Well, boy, there is a back and forth. And of course, Katty, you had for years the Russians trying to take control of Donbass. And so it does, according to Ms. Haines, this is going to be, Director Haines, this is going to be a long, hard slog. And yet you do have the Ukrainian foreign minister saying that Ukraine's concept of victory is ever evolving. He said at the beginning they were talking about the survival of Kyiv and the regime. Now they're talking about driving off the Russian Navy, reopening those Black Sea ports, taking control of all of Donbass. It does look like the two sides are going further apart instead of coming closer together for a negotiated settlement.
Yeah, I mean, nobody I speak to either from Europe or here in the U.S., Joe, at the moment thinks there's any chance of negotiation for exactly the reasons that you point out. The Ukrainians, well, the Russians don't want it. They're prepared to carry on this big fight for as long as it takes, potentially. And the Ukrainians feel they're making victories and now are saying, well, we think we could actually push the Russians right out of the Donbass. As Richard Haass just said earlier on, way too early, actually, the Russians are in a better position territorially than they were before this war began. They're not winning by any means, as the intelligence chief said up on Capitol Hill yesterday. At the moment, it's not clear that either side could really be calling this a victory. But what this means for Ukraine, I think, is that they have to carry on really trying to make sure the rest of the world doesn't lose interest. And you see them doing that. You see them saying, the fact that Odessa port is not working means that there will be food shortages around the world. In other words, this is the world's war. This is Europe's war. This is the United States war. It's not just Ukraine's war, because one thing that Ukrainian officials are really worried about is that we start losing interest. And if the West starts losing interest, there will be less pressure on Western governments to carry on the aid supplies, the military supplies that there have been to Ukraine. And they know they need those. They know they need those, which is why you're seeing this kind of push by Zelensky to kind of wake the world up, to say, look, you are going to suffer from the fact that Russians are bombing Odessa as well as Ukrainians suffering.
Well, for now, the West is engaged. The House of Representatives yesterday passed, last night, actually, $40 billion worth of aid. So that moves to the Senate now. As Joe mentioned, Russia's claiming its forces have made significant gains in eastern Ukraine 3 weeks after Moscow launched its offensive there. The Russian Defense Ministry yesterday said its troops have advanced to the border between Donetsk and Luhansk, the two Russian-speaking provinces together known as the Donbas. The ministry said it now controls more of the region than it did before the war started on February 24th. The Kremlin statement comes just a day after a Pentagon assessment revealed Russians had not made any progress on the ground. As David Ignatius just said, the director of national intelligence told the Senate Armed Services Committee that even if Russia does capture the Donbas region, the war is likely to continue.
The next month or two of fighting will be significant as the Russians attempt to reinvigorate their efforts. But even if they are successful, we are not confident that the fight in the Donbas will effectively end the war. We assess President Putin is preparing for a prolonged conflict in Ukraine, during which he still intends to achieve goals beyond the Donbas. We assess that Putin's strategic goals have probably not changed, suggesting he regards the decision in late March to refocus Russian forces on the Donbas as only a temporary shift to regain the initiative after the Russian military's failure to capture Kyiv.
Director Avril Haines there saying Putin believes Russia has greater ability and endurance and is, quote, probably counting on U.S. and EU resolve to weaken as food shortages, inflation and energy prices get worse. So, Jonathan Lemire, a couple of competing narratives here. First of all, the Russian foreign ministry, this should be viewed, all the information that comes out of there, with great skepticism. Remember, they're saying Ukraine is the aggressor in this war to begin with. What is the Pentagon, what is the White House view of this? I mean, Vladimir Putin can have all these goals he wants. He's shown no ability to actually execute them and carry them out. In fact, he's been pushed back in the other direction. But Director Haines made it pretty clear there that Ukraine and the United States should be prepared for this to go on for some time.
Yeah, a Kremlin fact checker would be pretty busy, yeah. Willie. But you're right. There is an area of agreement on this, is that both the U.S. and Russia both say, hey, the center is now the Donbas, and both sides seem to be preparing for a long slog. Officials I spoke to yesterday in the wake of that testimony say they think this will go months, if not a year or more. And they do feel like Putin does have some natural advantages here. Supply, as we've been talking on the show for weeks now, supply chains much shorter, supply lines much shorter there from Russia into the Donbas region. They've been in that territory for a while. Now, to be clear, so have the Ukrainians. That's their home. And they also have been able to reinforce. It was noted to me by a senior official last night that though Putin did not use the victory day, that May 9th moment to call for, you know, a mass mobilization, a full-scale deployment of troops or official declaration of war, they still have a significant advantage in manpower. Now, whether Putin chooses to use that or not remains to be seen. But Putin, of course, does not have the domestic political considerations that President Biden does or other Western leaders. Yes, of course, he is mindful of public opinion. He knows that at a certain point, this war has broad support, there's a sense that it's thin and that he doesn't want people to turn against him there. We know how paranoid he is about his own power. But he doesn't have midterm elections to worry about this November. And I think we heard from President Biden yesterday. We've heard from other European leaders as well, express worry about things like inflation and costs. And that's Putin's bet, U.S. officials believe, is that at a certain point, the Western resolve will simply fade. As the story moves further and further back in the newspaper, the headlines become less dire. We settle into this slog. But eventually, Western officials, Western leaders will not necessarily lose interest, but be able to commit less to the cause. And that's when Putin thinks he can take advantage.
Well, you know, we've been hearing that for some time. And I certainly, from people I'm talking to on the Hill, I certainly am not hearing it. It seems that there's a contest on who can flex their muscles more and say glory to Ukraine, Republicans or Democrats. So it's not happening there. I do fear that maybe you have leaders like Macron who go sideways and once again have dreams of a new security compact in Europe led by the French. But that ain't happening. But David, yesterday, let's go back to Director Haynes and her testimony. By the way, just a side note, she had to answer some of the stupidest questions, dumbest questions I've ever heard on Capitol Hill before. So dumb, they made my teeth hurt watching. You talk about felt sorry for her that she had to go in and answer some of those questions. My God. But enough of that. The headlines, though, David, and what I took note of, and I know you did, too. She talked about a war that could become more unpredictable and escalatory. I'm curious your thoughts there. We haven't talked since May 9th, since Putin's speech. And I'm just wondering what your general read is of Vladimir Putin right now and whether he may follow through on many of the threats or whether he is just going to put his head down and grind this out. Remembering, as I said yesterday, what Johan Cruyff said, if you can't win, then for God's sake, don't lose.
Putin is a grinder. The Russian people are good at protracted, difficult contests. We've seen that in wars for centuries. I thought the most important thing that Director Avril Haines was saying was that the hopes that many have expressed that the Russians, in focusing on the Donbas, focusing on the northeast in Ukraine, might be playing for a tie, in effect, might be playing for a smaller state that they would seize, a smaller territory. You'd then have a ceasefire line, and they would occupy that southern area, southeastern area of Ukraine. And Avril Haines, if I understood her, was saying, no, the Russian goals, Putin's goals remain fundamentally the same. He's still, in the long run, trying to control Kyiv, trying to deflect the course of Ukraine, pull it away from its alliance with the West. And she was saying that the mismatch between that continuing ambition, he still wants to be a big player in the center of Europe, and his capabilities, which are now limited. She said he couldn't achieve the things he wants to do. He couldn't seize the whole southern coast along the Black Sea. That mismatch could lead to a frustrating situation for him in which he might be tempted to escalate. And I thought that was the heart of the message she was trying to convey. His goals are larger than his abilities. And in that situation, people sometimes take higher risks and watch carefully and prepare ourselves, prepare NATO for that possibility.
Mika, it was a far more, so we look at these pictures of Vladimir Putin on Victory Day. It was a far more subdued Putin than I think I've ever seen over the past 20 years in public events. And the contrast between what he was celebrating, this glorious defense of the homeland, 25 million Russians dying, and then driving Hitler's Nazi armies out of the Soviet Union to save the country. And as a boy in St. Petersburg, growing up in St. Petersburg, his family profoundly shaped by the siege. And he had dreams his entire life of returning Russia to. You almost sensed yesterday or the day before was the first time it really started to sink in as he was shaking hands with these war heroes, these war vets, that he just doesn't live in a country that is capable of rising up to meet the demands that his dreams are foisting upon him. And in large part, that's because of the missteps. That's because of the mistakes. That's because of the autocratic moves he's made over the past 20 years.
Well, he thought this was going to be quick and easy, and it's been anything but for his military. Still ahead on Morning Joe, could Donald Trump have his Twitter account back before the midterm elections?
Democrats should hope the answer to that is yes.
We'll play for you Elon Musk's comments about the ban for the former president.
A better way to put that is Republicans are praying he doesn't.
Plus, abortion rights supporters make a direct appeal to Senator Susan Collins. We'll show you the messages they're leaving near her doorstep.
And why she called the police.
And we'll dive into the contentious back and forth between President Biden and Republican Senator Rick Scott of Florida. You're watching Morning Joe. We will be right back.
You called out Rick Scott a little while ago in your remarks. Earlier today, anticipating your remarks, he said, and I'm just quoting here, that the best thing, the most effective thing Joe Biden can do to solve the inflation crisis he created is resign. He's the problem.
Resign.
The senator added later, Joe Biden is unwell, he's unfit for office, he's incoherent, incapacitated, and confused. These are his words, offering you a chance to respond.
I think the man has a problem.
Yeah, Rick Scott.
Oh my God,
I love these Trumpers, Jonathan Lemire, that defended a guy that was proud of the fact that he could like spot a water buffalo, dog, cat, cow, woman, camera, or whatever it was.
Never that said he.
Donald Trump is still going around bragging that he doesn't have dementia, according to this test. And the things that he said, the rambling, I mean, he just is lost when he talks so often. And the fact that Trumpers go after Joe Biden, unbelievable. Hey, Joe's not Shakespeare, okay? Nobody ever said he was. Joe wasn't Shakespeare 40 years ago, right? But again, seriously, you're a Trumper? And you're criticizing Joe Biden because he's not articulate? That's kind of crazy, but it got personal awful fast. But Jonathan Lemire, it's almost like Rick Scott understands that he really stepped in it, not only for himself, but the Republican Party, because at this time, this economic time of hardship for working class and middle class Americans, he says that they're deadbeats on taxes, that they're deadbeats that need to pay higher taxes. That Rick Scott and the Republican super MAGA plan says that middle class and working class Americans are deadbeats, he says, because those deadbeats, Rick Scott says, and the MAGA Republicans say, aren't paying their fair share of taxes. Poor Elon Musk. Poor Bill Gates. How do these guys go to sleep at night knowing that Rick Scott has identified the problem for Republicans? That they think the working class are deadbeats that aren't paying enough taxes.
First, to begin with, an aside, I was part of the press pool in Air Force One maybe 3 years ago when President Trump started talking about that cognitive test and bragged that doctors told him, he said, that no one had ever done that before, had successfully achieved those five words. And now, years later, he is still doing it from the rally stage. But I think the thing about Rick Scott is, I think the tell here is how other Republicans have run away from him and run away from his plans. Senate Minority Leader McConnell has shoots death stares at Rick Scott every time he sees them, because I think Republicans go into this November's election, strategists have said to me, like, just keep your head down here. Like, you know, the environment looks good for Republicans. The party in power tends to lose seats. We know inflation, and we're going to get a report on this later today, is really bad right now. They feel like the trends are heading their direction. Now, whether that is true remains to be seen, but they don't want to commit unforced errors. And they feel like the Rick Scott thing is an unforced error. And the attack, the hypocrisy here of attacking President Biden for, you know, his alleged cognitive issues. I mean, it's absurd. And yes, does President Biden occasionally make mistakes? Yes. For instance, yesterday he said Rick Scott was from Wisconsin rather than Florida. But as you point out correctly, he's made gaffes his entire career. That comes with the Joe Biden package. And certainly he has never humiliated himself on the public stage like President Trump did when he was in office repeatedly.
Well, not even close. I mean, and you start talking about policy, and you have Joe Biden talking about policy press conferences. He can actually talk about policy. Donald Trump never could. But Willie, again, if Rick Scott were just a backbencher in the Senate, that would be one thing. He runs the Republican Senate campaign arm. He's the guy that's giving them the information on how to run their campaigns. And he believes that working class Americans and middle class Americans are deadbeats, and that these billionaires with rocket ships are paying too much in taxes. He believes that working class Americans and middle class Americans should be paying more taxes. So that's if you're running for Senate, that's what your guy is telling you to say.
Yeah, I mean, this was, as Jonathan just said, Republicans, not Democrats, Republicans are running in the other direction from this plan that Rick Scott put out that is bad business and has given the Democratic Party, including the president, some red meat to use, they hope, going into the midterms this fall. This is the president yesterday calling out specifically Rick Scott's plan, which the White House says, as you just pointed out, would raise taxes on working class Americans.
I want every American to know that I'm taking inflation very seriously, and it's my top domestic priority. My plan is to lower everyday costs for hardworking Americans, and lower the deficit by asking large corporations and the wealthiest Americans to not engage in price gouging and to pay their fair share in taxes. The Republican plan is to increase taxes on the middle class families, let billionaires and large companies off the hook as they raise prices and reap profits at record amounts. Really, ask yourself, how well are we going to sleep at night knowing that every 5 years, MAGA Republicans, if they're still Republican, this, as I said, this is not your father's Republican Party, if we're going to have to vote on whether you will have Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and what amounts you'll have in each of those programs.
So Democrats, obviously, Joe, have a tough fight coming up in the fall if they want to hold on to the House, which seems unlikely, and even the Senate. Mm-hmm. But to your larger point, this idea of President Biden sort of being out there and losing his cognitive ability, that's not just an offhand remark. It's sort of the thrust of the criticism in many quarters from conservatives, from the Republican Party on certain networks and podcasts and everything else. Yeah. This is it. And as you point out, Donald Trump, who is their almighty in many cases, brags and still is bragging within the last couple of weeks that he passed the dementia test, where you have to identify and circle a lion, a camel, and some other animals that you may have seen around the zoo.
Oh, it's so complicated. I don't know how he does it. And he's still bragging about it.
Well, he's proud of himself.
Bet he can be. Lion. I mean, way to go, Don. Way to go. By the way, we'll be showing clips later on. Alex, why don't you just pull up the Daily Show had a collection of Donald Trump clips. If people need to be reminded, you bring it up. We'll bring it up. I guarantee you it's not even mutually assured destruction, because Donald Trump looks far more incompetent than anybody that's ever been in that office. But, you know, Caddy Kay, it really is remarkable. What Rick Scott did is what Michael Kinsley used to define as a gaffe in Washington, D.C., when you accidentally tell the truth. You accidentally let people know what you think. And Republicans have long believed, and Rush Limbaugh always talked about, and the Wall Street Journal editorial page always talks about the poor beleaguered billionaires. They pay so much in taxes. Of course, it's ridiculous. Amazon paid zero in taxes over the past couple of years. Occidental Petroleum, Nike, other massive multinational corporations paying less in taxes than ever before. Billionaires paying less in taxes than ever before. Like the richest of the rich paying less in taxes than ever before. And in this environment, Rick Scott says what every Republican believes. We need to tax working class Americans so they'll have buy-in to the system. So they'll have buy-in to, I can't tell you how many times I've heard that said by Republicans behind closed doors. Like working class Americans that are scrapping to get by, they're deadbeats because it's the billionaires with their rocket ships to Mars that are paying too much in taxes.
Yeah, I mean, the irony of this is the timing. After 2 years of a global pandemic, who's the only group in the world that has actually done well out of the last 2 years? The ultra wealthy. They've got richer and richer during the course of the last 2 years because the stock market has boomed so much. They're not exactly the most people that I think most Americans would believe are deserving of government help at the moment. They are doing just fine. For the Republicans, this is a kind of odd play, which is why everyone is running from Rick Scott's plan, because they're trying to encroach on the traditional Democratic field of more working class Americans, Americans who don't have college degrees. They think that they have room there to try and pick up those votes. That's the area they want to appeal to. The big divide in America increasingly is going to be between educated and non-educated in terms of college degrees. And that's where Republicans could think they can do well. So why put out a plan that doesn't appeal to those people and appeals to the ultra wealthy who are probably going to vote for you anyway?
It's just ridiculous. You want to tax working class Americans, middle class Americans. Republicans have aggressively gone against Medicaid funding for rural hospitals, for rural health care centers, for rural nursing homes. It is rural America that has disproportionately paid the price for so many of these Republican cuts. And then again, Rick Scott again comes out and says a quiet part out loud for the Republicans who have long believed that poor billionaires get the short end of the stick. But David Ignatius, it goes to a bigger issue. And the bigger issue is, and I know you've seen it through the years, income disparity. It continues to explode. It's not just because of obvious, it's not because of just the tax system in the United States. A lot of it has to do, of course, with this information age. Elon Musk has said before, pretty soon I'll be able to just hire robots who can do the job of human beings far more efficiently. And I know Musk believes that, and a lot of other people believe that. But we do have a great challenge in this country regarding income disparity. That's another reason why this Republican plan to tax middle class and working class workers even more seems so counterintuitive right now.
Joe, I think you're absolutely right. The fundamental growing inequality of the U.S. economy in the time that I've been alive is a striking fact. The rewards to financial capitalism on Wall Street compared to the rewards for honest work in a steel mill, auto plant, you name it. The gap gets wider and wider. And I think it's part of what's killing this country. It's part of what gave rise to Donald Trump. You tour the Rust Belt and you see parts of the country that look like they were defeated in war. And somehow the Democrats have got to become the voice of those people who feel dispossessed again. There's no reason that they shouldn't be strong voices, especially against the Republican Party that talks about caring for the average man and woman, but still defends the prerogatives of the richest. I'm going to be watching the Ohio Senate race carefully, where Tim Ryan, a person from the Youngstown Rust Belt steel mill area, is going to be running against J.D. Vance. I think that's going to be a really interesting test of whether the Democrats can find language to speak to the ordinary working class voter and say, your future is better protected with us, and here's why. But the fundamental point you make, Joe, that really our country is getting more unfair. Everybody sees it. People are angry about it. And sensible Democrats have to address it now. I think you're exactly right.
The Democrats should be lined up, Mika, with working class Americans, with middle class Americans economically. They certainly are not culturally. They're just they are as disconnected culturally from rural Americans who should be voting 80% Democratic every year based on economic principles. But Democrats have been writing since 2004 books like What's the Matter with Kansas? Right. I've always told this story of when I was when the AFL-CIO was going after a lot of my Republican classmates mm-hmm. and just bashing them. And so I started bashing the union bosses in all my speeches. And I had a guy come in, fix my telephone when you used to have telephones on the wall and people would come in and fix the telephone. And the guy, very quiet, very polite. But he's leaning over and he's fixing the telephone and he says, Congressman. I go, yes, sir. He goes, you need to shut up. I go, excuse me? He goes, we're all voting for you. I said, who's all voting for you? He goes, every union member I know is voting for you. You need to stop bashing the unions. And I thought, well, you know what? I'm slow, but I'm not dumb. And I took that to heart. But there you had, again, people who were so culturally divided from the Democratic Party would never consider voting for a Democrat. And that's the challenge for Democrats right now, economically.
Yeah.
Working class Americans, middle class Americans, they line up with Democrats economically. They should. And Tim Ryan, I think, is a perfect candidate.
It's a great race
to reach out to working class and middle class voters. We'll see how that goes.
Absolutely. And coming up, are the peaceful protests outside the homes of Supreme Court justices worse than what happened on January 6th?
I don't see any cops getting beaten up there. Do you see any cops getting beaten up there?
I don't see blood or feces.
Is anybody spreading feces on walls there?
Yeah, I don't see a noose.
Are there any nooses saying hang Mike Pence there? Wait, does this?
I'm looking.
No?
Keep looking.
No, they're talking about free reproductive freedoms.
Okay, so Senator Ted Cruz does think so. We'll play for you his new comments. Okay. My God. Plus a night of mixed results for Trump-backed candidates in state primaries. What the results in Nebraska and West Virginia spell for the rest of the primary season. And Tom Brady has a lucrative retirement gig in place.
Whoever saw this coming.
Yeah, after he calls it quits from the NFL. Morning Joe is back in just a moment.
It is 6:44 in the morning, a beautiful live picture of the United States Capitol. Last night, two more Trump-backed candidates were on the primary ballot, and for the first time this election season, one of them lost. Jim Pillen won Nebraska's Republican primary for governor. He defeated Charles Herbster, who was supported by former President Trump. Trump campaigned for Herbster last week, even after eight women, including a Republican state senator, accused Herbster of inappropriately touching or kissing them against their will. Herbster has denied those allegations. And in a rare matchup of congressional incumbents, Trump-backed Alex Mooney defeated David McKinley in the Republican primary for West Virginia's second congressional district. New redistricting combined the lawmakers' districts after the state lost a congressional seat. Trump supported Mooney after McKinley voted for the bipartisan infrastructure package and supported creating a commission to investigate the attack on the United States Capitol.
Let's bring into the conversation White House editor for Politico, Sam Stein. Sam, good morning. Good to see you. Let's start back in Nebraska. Mr. Pillen, who won the Republican primary, he had the backing of the powerful Ricketts family, including the sitting governor, Pete Ricketts, former Nebraska football player, former Nebraska coach Tom Osborne supported him as well. He talked about schools and farms, did a lot of small events. His opponent, Mr. Herbster, had the backing of Trump and sort of latched himself to Donald Trump, hoping it would carry him over the finish line. It didn't work, at least statewide in Nebraska. What do you see in this result?
Well, two basic lessons for me. One is that a Trump-backed candidate can be toppled if the state party institutions all rally behind someone else. That if you have an infrastructure, GOP infrastructure, that says, no, we don't want this person, we want that person, even if they're not endorsed by Trump, it can work. It might take a bit of a miracle, but it can work. The second thing, this might be a little bit more Occam's razory, but it does not benefit you to run for office when eight women credibly accuse you of sexually harassing them or assaulting them. I mean, that's just, it's despicable on a personal level, but it's problematic on a political level. And I think in this case, look, this guy, Charles Herbster, he denied it. He said this, you know, these were all women who were trying to act to get him. He put himself in sort of the vein of Trump himself. But for voters, this is increasingly problematic. It's a thing that they cannot get behind. And you know, maybe it works for Trump in some contexts, but it didn't work here.
It does.
Well, yeah, it did work for Trump, obviously. But you look at the people that he endorsed, Sam, there are quite a few. I mean, let's start with Herschel Walker. If Republicans actually have standards when it comes to those type of charges, then a lot of people that Donald Trump supported are in trouble. I will tell you what's also so interesting here is one Republican heavyweight after another Republican heavyweight, one Republican standard bearer after another have seemed to go up against Donald Trump since 2015 and lost. Ricketts and the Ricketts family went up against Donald Trump and wiped the floor with him. I was fascinated that Governor Ricketts and the Ricketts family had absolutely no fear of Donald Trump. And by the way, what kind of message does that send that a guy with a future in Republican politics is like, I don't care who Trump's for. I'm going all in. And man, the Ricketts went all in and humiliated Donald Trump in Nebraska.
Right. I mean, I think, look, you can't say that Trump's influence is anything but pretty powerful within Republican ranks. We've seen it in a couple of the races. But I don't think it's as powerful as it's depicted in certain media accounts. Obviously, he's won in he won last night in West Virginia. He helped elevate J.D. Vance in the Ohio GOP primary. It pays to have his endorsement in the context of a Republican primary, but it's not insurmountable. I think in this case, Nebraska had a fairly robust Republican Party apparatus. They've been electing Republicans in the state for a long time, and the Ricketts family has a ton of money, has a ton of political cachet. State. And if you get behind a good candidate, and if you have a problematic, troubled opponent, it can work. And I think you're absolutely right in the respect that he said, you know what? I'm going to stand up for this candidate, not going to bow down to Trump. I'm going to roll the dice. And, you know, in this case, it came up well for him.
By the way, everybody, I just have to announce Sam Stein. He's very, very important.
Why?
He's just got a busy schedule. Alex just got in my ear and he said, Joe, Mr. Stein can answer one more question and then you have to clear him. So, Mr. Stein, I don't know what you have going, but obviously.
You just need this studio. You need to get someone else in this place for me. That's how unimportant I am.
Oh, you know what?
Sam, get out of here.
You know what? Okay. Can I just say the Southerner in me loves the false humility?
Yeah.
You are an honorary Southerner this morning. Politico Sam Stein, thank you so much.
Get out of the chair.
Kenny Kay, following up on what happened in Nebraska. And of course, Donald Trump does have, still has power with the party. But, you know, Vance not only had Trump, he had Peter Thiel's $10 million that got pumped into J.D. Vance's campaign there. How fascinating. The Ricketts basically tell Trump to get lost in Nebraska and humiliate him there. And I think what is so new this year, what we're seeing, Caddy, is the fear that everybody in the party used to have to, for Trump, top to bottom, that fear's going away. DeSantis hasn't flinched for months when they keep wanting to hear him say that he won't run if Donald Trump runs. Pompeo won't say it. Chris Christie won't say it. A lot of Republicans, they just don't fear Donald Trump anymore. And that fear, I mean, that's how he maintained power for so long in the party.
Yeah, I mean, there are two kind of parallel narratives. You've got the candidates who have been flying down to Mar-a-Lago and asking Trump for his endorsement. Even that kind of bizarre scene from Pennsylvania where they all flew down and started, you know, shouting about each other and criticizing each other in front of Donald Trump, like some kind of scene from The Apprentice played out in American politics. So you have got some of that still. You've got some candidates going there, but you've also got those, as in Nebraska, who are prepared to go up against Donald Trump. I think actually the more interesting story perhaps out of Ohio for Democrats, and something Democrats need to watch carefully, is that the turnout in the Republican Senate primary was twice that in the Democratic Senate primary. Now, that might just be because they had fewer candidates on the Democratic side, but if it points to a lack of enthusiasm on the Democratic side compared to the Republican side, that is something that Democrats have got to watch carefully. You know, it's been described as an alarm bell in Ohio. They need to know that they can get that enthusiasm up on their side by November.
All right, still ahead, newly released recordings of Senator Lindsey Graham praising President Biden and criticizing former President Trump.
You know,
right?
Lindsey got all teary-eyed when he was talking about what a great man Joe Biden was. You remember that one?
Yeah, this is right after the January 6th insurrection.
Oh, is this before the three people in the hound dog chasing through National Airport?
We'll play those
and
comments
he freaked
for
out
you.
And changed his mind again? I am off this bus. Woof. Okay, I'm back on it.
Okay. Joe, woof. Plus, Senate Democrats get a surprise supporter in today's vote on abortion rights. We'll get into why putting lawmakers on the record could actually backfire ahead of the midterms. Morning, Joe is coming right back.